Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Pablo Diaz. Now, Pablo holds dual PhDs from the Universidad Federal do Rio Grande do Sul in Brazil, probably really messed up the pronunciation on that, and Australia's Macquarie University in e-waste recycling, as well as a master's degree in photovoltaic recycling. As a professor and researcher specializing in recycling, sustainability, and environmental engineering, he focuses on life cycle assessment and environmental impact. He's also the co-founder of Solar Cycle, advocating for solar panel recycling and circular economy solutions. The book that we're talking about today is Climate Changed, The Science of Sustainability and How Each of Us Can Do Our Part. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Pablo.
Hi, Monica. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay. How did you get involved in this? I wouldn't say industry exactly, but this line of work.
Yeah. So I've always been passionate about, you know, the environmental problems. I thought in the back of my mind, we were doing something that wasn't quite right. Now I can translate that into being unsustainable was the feeling that I had. So in school, I was, you know, very interested in the topic of sustainability. Are we, you know, heading the wrong direction? What are the things we can do? And then when I, you know, finished high school, I really liked math, chemistry, physics, things that a lot of people run away from. I liked it. So I decided to do engineering because of that, you know, that affinity with these subjects. And within the engineering degree, I then gravitated towards the, you know, environmental side of things, which is the recycling, the idea around energy inputs, how can we maximize resources? What are the things that can be done around that specific area?
And this book, Climate Changed, what inspired you to write it?
So I was teaching, I've inherited a course, as so many do when they're teaching at university level. Somebody leaves and, you know, somebody needs to pick up the ball. And I've inherited a course to teach life cycle assessment, or LCA for short, which is basically a method we use to evaluate and quantify environmental impacts, right? It's the way that we translate the impact into numbers so that we can measure them and see how bad things are, how to measure against other things, how to compare different processes. It's a very powerful tool. And I've been using LCA as part of my research for a while, but it wasn't teaching it. And when you need to teach a subject, that's when you know you need to really deep dive and understand it really, really deeply to be able to teach others. And in that process, I was looking for books that could assist me. And I either found them to be too academic or too text heavy and dry, and good books nonetheless, but, you know, very hard for people that are new to the subject and students that are trying to understand this for the first time, or they were too far away from the scientific writing or too far away from the scientific literature to be more on the storytelling side and not really close enough so that I could use on my teachings. And so because of that space, that gap that I found, I decided to write the book mainly for my students, the students I was about to have, so that they could have that resource. But in the process, I ended up learning a lot myself about my own habits and about the things, the guilt that I was bringing with myself and the things that I was trying to do, thinking that I was making a big contribution, a big dent. And I've learned a lot of things that made me rethink my own life. And I thought this is actually useful for more people beyond university walls. So that's like the process of the book was firstly, the first idea was to write for my students. And then it evolved to be something that, yes, students can pick up and it's going to be helpful for them, but it's also going to be more for the general public that, you know, for these people like me who are passionate about the environment, passionate about climate, they want to understand the problems. Sometimes they really know climate change, but they want to understand other problems. Sometimes they really want to understand climate change better and they feel like they're not doing enough because often that's like we feel powerless and we feel like, you know, there's the problem is too big for us to do anything about. And I wrote this book to be able to help with these people.
Absolutely. And the title, Climate Changed, rather than Climate Change. What's behind that?
think it's a play on words that, you know, tries to say two things. One, you know, the climate has already changed in the sense that we're already experiencing, you know, a lot of the consequences of the things that have been predicted for many decades now by a lot of scientific minds and, you know, our main body that synthesizes everything, which is the IPCC for climate change specifically. And we have a lot of climate refugees. We have a lot of people feeling it in their skins year after year. So for those people, it has changed already. Their lives changed. They had to move. They've lost loved ones. They had to suffer a lot of the consequences of it. That's the first side of this this title. The second one is, you know, because it changed, we need to make changes ourselves too. We need to implement the changes in ourselves as society. And so the change also evokes the idea that the climate needs, because it's changed, we also need to make changes ourselves and accelerate towards a future that is sustainable for all of us.
So, you know, you talked about the LCA, which stands again for
life cycle assessment.
Life cycle assessment. So one of the things, I'm a little bit of a math nerd, so I really liked how in the book, when you were talking about the impact of different things, you actually walked us through the formula. How you came, you didn't just give this as X percent, you know, you walked through the formula of how you arrive at that, where you started from. I really, you know, probably not everybody is going to appreciate that, but I do.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, again, I try to write the book for a general audience. So I try to stay away. I don't use any formulas per se, but I do want to show like how things come about, right? So I start, for instance, there's a chapter we talk about water, and I say, like, you know, how much water can you probably save? And around, you know, we do some math, right? You drink this much water, this how much you need to shower, this how much you need. And, you know, we start seeing that it's really, excuse the pun, a drop in a bucket, right? In the case of like what we can save by our individual consumption versus real the big consumptions that happen elsewhere.
Right. And it must be frustrating though to see, you know, because part of this is, yes, make the changes in your personal life that you can make. But you have to go beyond that. We have to push for societal changes, for governmental changes, for regulatory changes. Keeping in mind, because you definitely focus on this too, that the regulations and so forth can't punish the people who are in lower income, less developed nations, that haven't had the advantage, you know, haven't reaped the benefits of the things that cause harm to our environment the way that we have. And so we have to keep that in mind too, you know, that poverty is also an issue. And I appreciate that too, that you're not ignoring that aspect of it. But it must be a little frustrating in a way to see, isn't it kind of two steps forward, three steps back in our, at least in the United States these days?
Yeah, I think it's a great point that you make. And absolutely, it was frustrating as I was, you know, writing and seeing, let's say, the little impact I would have at the end of the day. It was also liberating. And that change in mindset was very important for me. And I think it'll be important for other people that find themselves in a similar situation. It's, you know, you can look at this as, no matter what I do individually, my own, you know, small savings or my own things that I can do on my personal impact, it will not be enough, right? But you can also look at this as, even if not perfect, even if I can do everything I want to do, it's still okay, because these are small, you know, these are small actions. What really matter are the big actions. And if I focus my effort on these big actions, I can have leverage and I can impose change. And so when we think about, you know, one of the examples you bring is that of how do we support nations or communities or groups that, you know, still need that uplift in their lifestyles, right? So how do we support the global South that's going to have way more construction, which requires cement, which requires steel, to be able to have that infrastructure put in place without having to say, like, you cannot do that because that's going to create impacts? Well, that's, you know, the answer to that is through policies that allow the investment in technologies to be able to develop better materials for cement and for steel, yes, but also with technologies that are able to remove carbon from the atmosphere, and also with the reduction of those that are, you know, having the biggest impact today. So it's a combination of all these things, and these comes through, you know, policy, government action, corporations moving on the right direction. It's not, you know, you and I buying green steel and green cement, right? That's not how these things are going to happen.
Right. But as an individual, you know, when I'm trying to do things that are better for the environment, it's hard sometimes to know what really makes a difference and what doesn't.
So absolutely.
You do address that. You do give some ideas, some hints about what really does make a difference and what doesn't. But one of the things that I've, you know, really wondered about is recycling plastic.
Yep.
When I put my plastic bottle in the recycling bin, is that actually helping anything?
Yep. And we can talk about that for sure, especially, you know, given my background in recycling. And I'll tell you that, you know, every time you put things towards a recycling bin, you're helping already, because separation process is one of the things that takes a lot of, you know, energy, effort, money at the end of the process. So if you can do it ahead of the process, it helps. Now, will that plastic bottle be recycled per se? Hard to say. Depends on where you are. Depends on the economics of the place. It depends on the plastic itself. So if you think that, you know, I have to recycle this, and if this is not recycled, I'm doing a big harm to the planet, that I think is a problem. That's problematic, because yes, it's helpful if you put it in the right recycling bin. That's already helpful. Should you stop there? No, right? So the whole idea of the book is to remove that guilt or that pressure of you thinking about this plastic bottle, especially, you know, in places where there's a good waste management infrastructure, right? So the worst case scenario for it, it's going to go to a landfill, which is not ideal. None of us want that, but that impact is actually quite, quite small. So I wouldn't focus too much on that plastic bottle per se, but rather think, yes, absolutely, if you have the chance, put it on the recycling bin, you're doing a great job. If you have, you know, if you have that day that it's chaotic and you couldn't really clean up the plastic bottle for whatever reason, you feel bad about it, don't feel bad about it. But no matter what, don't stop there. Go to the next step, right? The next step, the big steps, is where you really want to, you know, focus your attention. And that's when you're trying to help the communities that are already doing things, that are trying to leverage, you know, the government policies that are already in place. You're trying to vote in for politicians that are, you know, pushing for this cause. You're trying to, you know, make changes in your community, be it for efficient buildings or building code. And those things really, really move the needle. So again, the whole idea behind the book is, does it matter if you put your recycling bottle in the right bin? Yes, it helps. If everybody does that, are we going to solve a problem? No, we won't. So don't feel too guilty about it. Do the right thing so you know you're doing the right thing, but then use that as a, you know, trampoline to go into the next steps, the big steps.
One of the things, you know, my main background is accounting and business, and the business I'm in is not particularly environmentally friendly, to be honest. It's we make products out of plastic and steel and things like that. It's manufacturing consumer products, but I try and be as green as possible in that process. So for example, I invested about $1 million in solar panels at our factory in Mason City, Iowa, to, you know, reduce our energy requirements there. And, you know, I put a really high-class air scrubber at my plant in Mexico, to try and to be sure that we were, you know, not harming the air with soap. But still, I'm making plastic and steel products, you know. It's like,
right, yeah.
And that whole sort of, to really be environmental would have to change so much about our economy that it's very difficult to see that path, how that would happen. On the other hand, as an accountant, as a finance person, one of the things that has always bothered me is that we as a society do not allocate the costs of harm to what is causing the harm. And that means that the economic valuation of different products and different for different energy sources, for example, is not true. It's not true. So the idea that, well, solar, you have to subsidize solar. We shouldn't be subsidizing solar because, you know, we should let the market decide. But the problem is that we're already subsidizing fossil fuels. It's just not visible in the way it's not being allocated. It's not visible. Our entire military is basically a subsidy of fossil fuels. A great deal of our healthcare costs is a subsidy of fossil fuels. Is there anybody out there who's doing that math that can really prove that?
Yes, there's a lot of good studies, I think, around that. And I think you're really touching on the core of this whole discussion, right? Which is, like you said, at some point you put solar panels and you were able to make that decision. And that only happened when solar panels reached a cost that was not outrageous, right? You could go back and say, like, you know, and maybe it's going to be a bit more.
And we did get tax credits that helped too.
Right. Of course.
Yeah.
But then how do we get to that point, right? It wasn't, you know, out of the blue that all of a sudden solar panels were A, available, B, efficient, three, cheap, right? We had first, they were developed in the, you know, in the Bell Labs in the USA. That was like their first appearance to the world. Then we had, you know, Germany put heavy subsidies to develop the industry. We had Japan doing a big push. And finally, we had China that basically made, you know, this whole infrastructure to manufacture solar panels that we have today and really drove the cost down to the ground. And all these things were policy, right? These were, you know, groups of people, be it governments, be it, you know, corporations, organizing groups that said, this is our directive, we're going to do this because we think this is there's an end goal here. And indeed, right? Then we get to the point in which solar panels are now cheaper than a lot of other energy sources. So the same thing can be said by for, you know, pick your topic. That's going to be, you know, the theme here. And like you said, it's very hard once you have all the infrastructure around fossil fuels to basically just flip a switch and move in the other direction. So the good news there is we are moving in another direction. We are already, you know, decarbonizing the economy year after year. So we're already heading on the right direction. My view is that we're not heading fast enough, right? And I think this is super, super helpful and hopeful if you are an individual that cares, because if you think, you know, we're doomed, this is so hard, there's no way for us to do it, like that's very, very tough to, you know, challenge a problem if you're looking at it like that, which is, you know, I'll be the first to admit, several times I've had that thought. But digging through the data, right, looking at the actual numbers, like in your background in accounting is going to, you know, it's exactly like what you want to do. Yeah. It, you know, we do see we're heading in the right direction. There's progress. Absolutely. There is progress. We are in, you know, we're going to end up achieving net zero. Now, will it be by 2050? That's the question that is hard to answer. And like, that's what we need to accelerate because, you know, guess what? There are people that are already feeling the impacts. And every, you know, every second that we delay this, it's going to be worse for some people, for some groups. And so it's how do we accelerate these transitions that are already taking place?
Yeah. In your book, you did a calculation or reported about a calculation of how many Earths are required to meet our current pattern of consumption. Well, you want to just, and actually that was more hopeful than I expected, the result. You want to explain that and how you came to that conclusion?
Yeah, for sure. That's a calculation that's done based on the carbon emissions or the carbon consumption of, you know, individuals. And it's no mystery that, you know, different people have different, you know, living behaviors and patterns or lifestyles, but that's also true for different regions of the world or even countries, right? So depending on where you pick and choose, you're going to end up with different values, right? If you do, you know, how many Earths would we need? And this is, you know, exclusively a carbon equation. How many Earths would we need if the US was the, you know, pattern all across the globe? It will be, you know, many Earths, I think four to seven, something on that order of magnitude. If it were, you know, a country that has a much less development and people don't consume as much, let's take a country just Thailand as an example here, you probably need less than one Earth to be able to keep up with that lifestyle. And so it's interesting to, like, you know, choose the different places to see, like, these differences for two reasons. One is, you know, that tells you, points you in like how we need to change the policies and the, you know, environment to allow for it to be sustainable for everyone, right? It's one world after all. And so the end goal is that we consume one planet or less than one planet, right? That's the end goal. One planet for really, really be like playing with fire kind of thing, right on the edge. Yeah, like, all right, yeah. You know, and what does that mean? It means that, you know, basically we're taking away from Mother Nature as much as it can replenish, and we're, you know, producing waste as much as it can absorb. That's basically what one world would mean in this case here. And so that's the first thing. It's like to see these differences, right? The second thing, in my opinion, which is very useful to look at these numbers, is to think about, okay, so if I am consuming more than one planet, what would it mean for me to consume one planet or less? Like, what does that mean in practice? Like, am I going to give up my car? Am I going to, you know, not just have to eat less food than I eat today? What are the things that I really need to give up? I think this is another point that is, at least for me, was extremely insightful, because, you know, through discussions with people on my personal life, but also with students at the university, we often go back to this, that idea of being either like hunter gatherers, and to put that in quotes, right? Like going back to like very more primitive life with less luxuries and all. And it's really not that. And that really amazed me when I looked at the numbers. There's a great study that talks about this idea that, you know, people think we need to go back to living into caves, but you run the numbers and these caves are pretty similar to the house we have today. And if you live in the US today, you know, you don't need to give up a lot of your luxuries, just some of them. And so, for instance, it's not that you can't, for instance, eat meat, which is a, you know, something that has a high impact associated with it. It's just that you probably want to, you know, eat meat three less, or four times per day per week, right? Yeah. Much like it's not like you need to, you know, completely change your lifestyle. It's like change a little bit. You can still drive, you can still have, you know, air conditioner, you can still have laundry, you can still have internet energy. So the life that we need to be sustainable worldwide for a population of 11 billion, which is where we're heading before we stabilize, is not so bad as people think. You do need to cut back on a few things if you live in a very affluent country or you live a very rich lifestyle. Yes, you will need to cut back on a few things, but it's not as bad as you think.
And what would make it even easier, or what makes it possible to do that, or would make it possible to do that, is changes sort of in our community infrastructure.
100%.
Much better mass transit in the U.S. could certainly help people here. Although there are cities in the U.S. that have great mass transit, but there are also many that do not. It's like the older cities do, and the newer cities don't, for the most part. Isn't that the way it kind of goes?
I think that's a pattern in the U.S., yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you would think that the newer cities would, as they are being built out, would have taken that into consideration. But there was something about the culture, I think, in the mid-20th century where, and there's a lot of, you know, the whole growth of the suburbs and every, you know, everybody having their own vehicle and getting in their own vehicle and nothing in the suburban neighborhoods that you could walk to do anything. And, you know, what was it in our kind of national psyche that caused that at that time? And I have some thoughts on that, but they're kind of a little bit off the subject.
No, I think actually it's a great, I think it's also part of what we're discussing, because you're making a great point. And, you know, I have a few stories about this in the book, but I lived in many different places. And one of them, for instance, was Sydney, where I was teaching. And in Sydney, I lived quite far away from my work, yet I could bike to work quite comfortably. The whole, you know, there were bike lanes, super safe. I could go on two ways, be home, you know, without spending more time than I would if I were driving a car.
Wow.
I also lived in, you know, in Brazil, in my hometown, where it's dangerous to drive a bike because you don't have the appropriate lanes, or the lanes are, you know, not in great shape. If you need to ride at night, it's, you know, you don't want to leave your bike outside. So it makes it very hard for you to be a bike commuter for your everyday tasks. Mm-hmm. And now I live in Phoenix, Arizona, where I'd love to ride my bike to work, but basically it's, you know, we're talking 25 miles because everything is spread far apart.
Not to mention there are, it's so hot, yeah, it could be dangerous at times.
It's different conditions, right? So there's no bike lane between where I live and my work. And, you know, I also thought about public transportation. Well, guess what? There literally isn't public transportation that goes to my company. So I don't have that option, right? And again, back in Sydney, in Brazil, the public transportation was there available in different degrees of how comfortable it was. And Sydney was extremely comfortable. But it goes back to the little steps and the big steps. Yes, absolutely. Can you take public transportation? Is that better? Yes, it is. Can you bike? Is that better? Yes, it is. If everybody were to bike, would it solve it? No. Will everybody start biking unless we have a big infrastructure around it? No, right? So look at the Netherlands. Netherlands is the best example for biking. It's all made for bikes. It's more convenient to ride a bike than it is to drive a car. There's more places to park. There's more places to leave it. There's more, you know, infrastructure to ride it than a car. When that takes place, which is exactly what, you know, your example is, like, how is a city designed for? Then you're basically pushed towards doing the right thing. You don't need to, like, you know, do an uphill battle to do what's better for the environment and for sustainability in general.
Okay. Let's say we live in a community and we want to make it more bike friendly, but there's, of course, a lot of other reasons to have bike paths. But if it was just for the carbon, or, you know, for the sustainability in terms of climate change, how much would building those bike paths offset the savings you would get from people using them? And is anybody doing those calculations?
Yes. So I don't have that number right now to give you, so I won't give you any numbers, but it's what we call the carbon payback time, right? That's what your question is asking. And that is, again, a metric that exists already. It can be calculated, and it's precisely that, right? So if we're just talking carbon, how much carbon are we going to emit to do all these changes in these infrastructures? And then how much do we expect to save on a per person that converts over to not driving and biking instead? And then that's going to give you two numbers. You're going to divide them, and you're going to say, all right, within 3 years, making this number up, that's going to be paid back. Again, and one example of this, just to make it concrete, is solar panels, right? You need to invest energy, produce materials to make a solar panel, and then it's going to start producing energy without emitting CO2. Payback time for solar panels is less than 1 year, right? So in less than 1 year, you're already paid back all the carbon that's required to make that solar panel in the first place, transport it to the right location, install it, et cetera. So, you know, those kinds of equations exist already. And absolutely, there's something you can calculate before making a decision.
So what is it for EV batteries, electric vehicle batteries?
So for EV, that's a very good question. So for EV batteries, it takes a bit longer. And I'm not going to say like EV batteries in a vacuum, but rather EV vehicles, because really your savings are over time, right? Because you're riding the vehicle and emitting less than the vehicle that is the internal combustion engine one. So it's more than 1 year. It's going to vary make by make. There's a lot of nuances there. I remember that this is one example we used in class a few years ago, and it was between 5 and 10 years on average for the payback time.
Okay.
That probably has changed since I have the latest data, but just to give you like a rough order of magnitude idea.
Okay. So if you're changing out your car every 5 years, you're really not helping the environment.
Or you're netting like just exactly the same. Exactly.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of nuance to this, right, Monica? I try to bring this to the book, right? Because this tool that we use to calculate, it's amazing. And the answer to all these questions is going to be, it depends. That's the general answer.
Yes.
It depends.
How much do you drive?
How much do you drive? Exactly, right? How much do you drive? What kind of climate are we talking about? What vehicle did you buy? How much did the other vehicle consume? What's going to happen with the battery at the end of life? Is it going to go to, you know, a landfill? Is it going to go to recycling? All these things, they're going to change this equation one way or the other. And they're going to change for carbon, but they're also going to change for all the other environmental impacts. So it is indeed very, you know, it's a very nuanced subject, And it's one that I find it fascinating, right? We can talk about that the whole call if you wish, because it's, you know, it's, it allows you to make these comparisons and to be able to get an answer out of it. And one example I had from the book is I was, again, doing my best to do everything I could for my environmental impact. And I stopped eating meat at some point. I became a vegetarian. And there was this pizza in Australia that was vegetarian, and I really liked it, but it came from Germany. And I was like, wow, is this better than eating like a meat lover's pizza made in Australia? Like, wow, how am I going to choose? So I did the calculation myself. I got an answer and I was able to choose. And, you know, that's
okay,
what
we
hanging. It was
the
actually
answer?
the Germany was actually the pizza from Germany was actually lower on a carbon footprint perspective than the other one.
Okay.
So that's how I made my choice. But the whole point of making these, and I can tell you so many stories of things that I did. But the whole point was at some point I was like, wow, you know, these individuals, I'm like spending all this energy, all this mental energy, all these things, making these choices when this is really the small steps, right? I'm better off focusing this energy on writing a book that I can, you know, publicize and share with others. I'm better off, you know, if I can help communities and donate to, you know, causes that are already making these big steps. I'm better off if I can work with my with the government, be it local or federal or whichever, like, you know, instance you're talking here, and, you know, propose policies and, you know, back things with the data that I have. These are the big steps. And once that mindset shift occurred, that was liberating for me, because I was spending so much energy fixating on is my plastic bottle being recycled or not? Am I right choosing the right pizza? Am I going to take the elevator to go up to my floor at work, or the stairs? How is that impact?
Oh, I always take the stairs, but it's only two flights. So it's like not that hard to do, but it's like, I'm like, I'm not taking the elevator. That uses electricity. I'm taking
exactly.
the stairs.
Exactly. No, exactly. Like, you know exactly what I'm talking about then. It's like,
yes.
And you know, that means you care, right? It means you care about
right,
these things
right.
And you want to do the right thing. And this book is exactly about this. It's like, what are the right things? Like,
but if I'm carrying enough stuff, then I will take the elevator because, but how much stuff is enough to make it justified?
Exactly. No, that's exactly how, you know, this math works out. And my whole point is these things are great. Don't stop there. And if you can't do it because you're tired, because, you know, your knee's hurting because you have too many things, don't worry about it. Let go. It's not that big a deal in the grand scheme of things. The big steps are much more important.
Yeah, absolutely. So climate change, the science of sustainability and how each of us can do our part. It's structured in three parts. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. It's three parts. The first part is how we got here in the first place. So it's a very brief, you know, look at history on, you know, when did we start, you know, damaging the environment? When did our environmental impact start as a society in the first place? And we talk about, like, you know, the idea that we always think about the 18th century with the Industrial Revolution as the epicenter. And there's a good reason for that. But it's not like we were living, you know, the super imbalanced life before, right? We have the whole, if you take the 15th century with Spain and Portugal as an example, going to these other countries and completely decimating population, but also, you know, the harvesting of natural resources, that was complete chaos from an environmental perspective, right? Complete ecosystems destroyed. So it's not like we were like these, you know, these very peaceful societies that were doing everything right as far as the environment goes, and then all of a sudden we create these machines and everything starts to go haywire. In reality, what changes is just our power over how much damage we can make, right? On the 18th century with this revolution, the amount of change we could exert on the environment, the amount of impact was, you know, amplified significantly. And that's where that's why we point to that, you know, point in history as the epicenter. But then the 19th century is where we start to get the first consequences and the first data points that point something being array. In the 20th century is when we first start getting treaties around it and sounding alarm bells and it becoming a wider spread subject that people discuss, but also that we start putting, you know, some barriers around doing the right thing, Clean Air Act, whaling programs, all these things that, you know, we associate with environmental movement. So it's the first time the environmental movement really organizes itself more broadly. And now we're in the 21st century in which we need to actually do execute and do the things that we've learned about the last century, right? So this is the time to do it. So this is very broad brushstroke on the history. And the second part is around the problems. So this is where I define the problems. And yes, I talk about climate change. I think it's, you know, front and center for a lot of us. And I do explain it in detail and try to make a lot of analogies for people to understand A, what it is, but B, how we measure it, C, what are the consequences. But this is one thing that's very different from other books. I don't stop on climate change. I use climate change as like a hook to pull you in, because you probably know a little bit about it. But then I go into other environmental impacts. So we talk about acidification. We talk about eutrophication, which is basically when you put too many nutrients into water bodies and you create this whole imbalance in the ecosystems. We talk about abiotic depletion, which is basically consuming more resources, that non-living resources that we need to use today to build our societies, but they're also going to be needed in the future. As an example, copper here. So I talk about all these other environmental impacts beyond climate change, and I define them and at least give, you know, a high level idea of what they are. And then the last part of the book, the third part, are the solutions, right? So I told you all these things that are happening. So what do we do about it? And in the solutions, that's where I break it down into the little steps, which are the things that we can do individually, which are things we talked about, like, you know, our transportation habits, our eating habits, how to save water, how to save energy, which they help and they get the momentum. And they often is where we, you know, feel the most guilt. And I conclude that chapter saying, note, and the whole chapter is about this, right? It's like, I'm showing like, this is the impact that you can have. Look at it. It's great. But then compare with the big picture and see how small it is. And so if we all were to do our small parts in our little corner of the world, we would not solve the problem. If we all became vegetarians, if we all saved as much water as we can at home, if we all, you know, turn off all those lights, we'd still have the same problems we have today. It's going to decrease a little bit, but it's still all there. And so that's paralyzing. No, that's not my point. It's not paralyzing. It's actually liberating. Think about it this way. Use these small steps as a trampoline, as momentum building, so that you can go to the big steps. And then we go into the big steps, which is things we talked about, the changes in the systems that are required, the changes in our electrical matrix that we go from net zero, go from where we are to net zero. It's the changes in the governments. It's the building standards that we put in place. It is how we change agriculture, transportation, all these big things that we're not going to do individually, but we can very much do as collective groups that organize.
Do you think there are people, and I'm guessing there probably are, who are very concerned and do everything they can individually and yet still vote for the big pollution?
100%. 100%. Yes, I think so. And I think, you know, that's one of the things, like, voting is extremely powerful in democracies anyways, and often overlooked as, you know, one environmental thing you can do.
Right.
And I, you know, I think both in the local sphere and the federal sphere, I think, you know, sometimes local governments and local communities have more power to act and do implement changes that are important than the big one when we have, you know, very politicized and bipolarized situation going on. So I absolutely think that happens. Voting is absolutely one of the big steps. There are other things you can do even beyond voting, right? You can donate your time to causes or to groups that are already, you know, doing the movements that you want to support. But you can also donate money if you don't have the time, because, you know, sometimes life gets busy and you have work and you have kids and you have to do all these things and you want to help, but you don't have time. These people need support. These people need money to be able to do the things they need to do. So there are other ways beyond voting.
Are there any groups in particular that you recommend supporting?
So I think that's very particular. I'm very particular about that. And I did not put that in the book on purpose, because these things change and more things come to light. So yes, I do support a few groups. I support one group that's called Give Directly, which is, like the name implies, it's a donation that you give directly to people that need the most and that are going to have most impact in their lives, so that they can increase their living standards. So this is more about poverty, which is completely related to, you know, the environment, but it's one way to do it. I also support a group called Kiva, K-I-V-A, which is a similar idea that you're supporting, you know, local entrepreneurs and small people that they can then build them themselves and be more resilient to climate, but other things. And I also support a group called the Basel Action Network, which is for electronic waste and, you know, very close to my heart.
Ah.
And the work that they do to stop people from exporting basically waste to other nations that don't have the infrastructure to deal with it. So that's those are the three organizations that I support today. I don't not saying these are the right ones, the ones right one for me. And I'm always updating that, you know, as new information comes to light, as I get to know other groups. I sometimes stop one, open another one. And so this is very dynamic for me. Okay. And I encourage, you know, people to do their research around it.
And I'm not going to put you too much on the spot, but are there like maybe well-known environmental groups that aren't really as environmental as they
yes.
seem? Yeah.
Yes. And I've I'm not going to name names. Some of them are not here anymore. So, but yeah, I've been stopped and asked for donations for a few times in which I like, sure, let me look into it. And, you know, they don't have to dig that deep to find that things aren't quite as they seem. So yeah, absolutely. And that's, again, one of the reasons why I don't put it in the book, right? In print, because if I were to find something out, I would not want to be the, you know, the person sponsoring that and putting associated my name. So I do always say what I'm doing now, like I just did.
Yeah.
But those things are dynamic and they can change. So yeah, I've seen that before, unfortunately, Monica.
Pablo, why don't you read a little bit from Climate Changed?
Yeah, for sure. I'll be happy to. So I was thinking it would be great for our listeners to get a, you know, snippet of the introduction and then a snippet of the closing thoughts, the final thoughts in the book.
Sounds good.
So they can have a really good, you know, idea of what the book is about. So in the introduction, I'll go straight into it. I had been searching for a long time for a book that could teach me what I need to know about the environmental challenges we face in the 21st century. I felt constantly inundated with information, yet I didn't have a clear sense of what the threats are exactly. How bad are they? Are they all related to climate change, or are there other things going on? While we're at it, how bad is climate change really? Can we connect all the climate events we see in the news to human activity, or do we need more evidence? What are the ways forward, realistically speaking? And what can I do about it? Do my actions even matter? Oh yeah, and I wanted all of this explained in simple, plain language that was easy to digest. I didn't want a book by scientists for scientists. Rather, I wanted one that was accessible to a mainstream audience, a book that successfully translated complicated topics so that everyone could understand them, simplifying as much as possible while staying true to the evidence and the scientific consensus. The more I look, the more I realize this approach was hard to find. Ultimately, I was unable to find such a book. I read several in the process, but many were too focused on a single country or region, typically North America or Western Europe. And sure, there are many important lessons to be learned from these countries that are ahead in policymaking and that have way more experience polluting the planet. But physics, chemistry, and biology don't care much about the political borders we have imagined for ourselves. A book addressing the global issue of our current environmental challenges seemed pressing. And I mean all environmental challenges, not just climate change, which has become the exclusive focus of many publications and in the media in general. While there are many great reads out there, none of them were the accessible, comprehensive, science-based, and solution-focused book about the environment I was looking for. And since I could not find it, I decided to write it. I'm not a climate expert, nor am I an environmental scientist, at least not by formal training. I'm an engineer who specializes in waste management and environmental engineering as both a scientist and a university professor. Formal expertise is not what I bring to the table. What I offer is quite the opposite, ignorance. I wrote this book out of a huge curiosity and humility that is necessary for learning, and the passion to make a positive impact. These are the traits that I believe we all can and should possess. So that's the snippet from the introduction. And I'm not sure, should I just jump to the final thoughts, Monica?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. And so as part of the final thoughts, this book was written to reach an audience beyond university walls in a relatable way that is hopefully easy to understand, and to try to simplify a complex problem while remaining true to the current scientific evidence and consensus. The objective is that upon finishing this book, you have an understanding of the major environmental issues facing our planet, their importance, what is needed to address the situation. Specifically, this book should have assisted you in developing your own environmental lens to evaluate different situations and determine what you can do on your own. After reading this book, I also hope you agree with me that while an individual's contribution is of utmost importance, the change we really need requires collective action and drastic systemic shift. That is, it is not enough to address your own personal impact without addressing the global impact too. This understanding is of the utmost importance, yet it is also too easy to misinterpret it. In the Madhouse effect, how climate change denial is threatening our planet, destroying our politics, and driving us crazy, author Michael E. Mann and political cartoonist Tom Tolles perfectly sum up the issue in the following sentence. Quote, "Ultimately, we are left with one real solution, reducing our collective carbon footprint. However, note how easy it is to interpret reducing our collective footprint as we all each reduce our own carbon footprint," effectively ignoring the collective part in the statement. Rather, we should read this as we all reduce the collective carbon footprint. Slight change in interpretation, huge difference in the course of action to be taken. Most of us go about life without really thinking about our obligations to the wider society. But as human beings who share a single planet and who do not live completely isolated, we have the moral, practical duties to serve. The extent of these duties has been widely discussed by different schools of thought and philosophies. As an example, libertarian, Kantians, utilitarians, etc. And it's not within the scope of this book to debate these. But as a scientist and engineer, and most importantly, as a citizen of this planet, it seems quite obvious that we all have a practical obligation towards the environment for the simple reason that ignoring this obligation up till now has led us to where we are. If you live in a civilized society, you respect the laws, both legal and societal, that we all agreed upon and that theoretically allow you to live alongside others. If you don't agree with such laws, you can take action to change them. While the power structure is admittedly not fair to everyone, this is the agreement we're all subject to in modern democracies. So the deal you enter in order to have a paved road, take public transportation, receive potable water at home, have access to public goods and sewage system is all that you will pay your taxes, among other duties. By the same token, I would argue if you live on planet Earth, you must live sustainable life and have a sustainable environmental footprint. I'll stop here.
Thank you. And that was Pablo Diaz reading from Climate Changed, The Science of Sustainability and How Each of Us Can Do Our Part. So you were looking for this book to use in your class, couldn't find what you're looking for, decided to write it yourself. Where did you begin?
It was with life cycle assessment, with LCA specifically. That's where I began.
Okay.
It was explaining that part of that tool, like what it was used for, and explaining the different environmental impacts. Right? And from there, I started to increase the scope because it was, the scope was limited to like, oh, my students need to understand what this tool is and what the environmental impacts are. And I want them to like have, you know, clear analogies to be able to relate these subjects. From there, I expanded the scope And as I wrote the book, I was like thinking about my own life and the discussions we had today. And I was like, this, I think there are other people in the same situation and it would benefit them to get the data that I got through this process.
Yeah. And the book, it's not dry, you know, it's like you put yourself in it, which isn't something probably that normally would you'd see in a textbook for a college class. So you obviously decided to write it for a more general audience. And so originally, were you thinking of writing it just as a textbook? And then at some point you actually...
Yes.
And when you did that, did you have to go back and revise everything that you'd already written?
Basically, yes. Yes. So I started it with the textbook approach, but again, trying to be more relatable and already, you know, being easier to digest, especially for students, right? These people are young, they're passionate about the subject, and they encounter something that's very dry and they're like, oh, here we go. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
It's a topic they love. So I was trying to do the opposite, like, hey, let's, you know, relate these things. Let's relate, you know, acidification with things from your life. Let's relate these things, these fancy words you never heard, but they are part of your daily life. And so I already, you know, it was supposed to be a textbook, but not a dry textbook from the start. And then, yes, once it became, you know, once it went beyond university walls, and it wasn't, you know, just meant for students at university level anymore, I had to revise it many, many, many times.
How long did you spend working on it?
Basically from 2021 all the way through 2025.
Okay.
So, and literally January 1st, 2021 is when I started writing it. So it was...
Was this your New Year's resolution?
It was part of it. Yeah. I had like the goal of like, I'm going to, because I've been fiddling with it for a while. I was like, all right, I'm going to take this seriously. I'm going to write this book. Right. So
okay.
I actually have a calendar that I have a photo of that I would do an X for every day that I wrote. And in that year of 2021, I think I've missed two or three days out of the 365.
Wow.
So
now,
I was
were you writing early in the morning, late at night, in between things? Because obviously you had a day job.
Yeah, and this was COVID times, right? 2021.
Yeah,
in Australia, yeah. We had a lot of lockup situation.
Okay.
And, you know, there was a lot of restrictions about what we could and could not do. It was mainly at night before, you know, bedtime. When I finished all my other duties, I would sit down and write for as long as I had the energy to do so. A lot of it revising, you know, papers and revising textbooks to be able to get the most accurate evidence-based information.
Were you doing a lot of research as you were writing, or did you already know a lot of this beforehand?
I'd say I'd had probably 80% of it I had to do a lot of research for, and 20% of it I had already enough knowledge from other, you know, research that I've done in the past to be able to just convey it to the page and just relate it to the evidence behind it.
Now, did you outline it before you started writing?
Yes, I did outline. So not the, again, like, because I started with the textbook part, it was just the outline of the problems chapter.
Okay.
And so, and then I then expanded to the, you know, the history and the solutions. So I outlined the problems section first, the second part of the book. And then when I decided to increase the scope, then I outlined the whole thing and I went through from finish and I cut so many things. You probably hear this from all the authors, Monica, but the book could be twice as big. There's a lot to cover that I ended up not including there.
Well, it's a very manageable size to read, which I think is useful. If it had been twice as big, I think it would be intimidating for someone to pick up. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. So at what point were you able to get a publisher or to find your publisher?
This happened, I think, in 2024, if I'm not mistaken, early 2024. Ended up working with Otterpine. They're great, really, really good publishers. They helped a lot in the process and they're still helping to this day with, you know, getting the book out there with more people. So, 2024, and then was a long process of basically a year and a half of like other revisions and, you know, getting it ready for the public.
Did you have, readers before you got to that point? Did you have people who were giving you feedback? And
yes, 100%. And one of the best readers I had was actually my mom. My mom is a researcher. She's a, you know, a university professor, and she read a few times and, you know, put a lot of red lines and like, oh, watch out for this. And she was really like, you know, like a peer review kind of thing. She was like looking at the science and the, you know, the references and marking things like that. So it was really good to have her help me out.
Now, this is the first book that you've written?
It's the first general audience book. So I have, you know, obviously many publications and researcher books that are specifically for research and very dry, if you will. This is the first one that is, yeah.
Okay. And will you do more?
I have a few ideas and I have a few sketches already. I think it really depends on how much this resonates with people. If you know, I see that the public is really, this is reaching a broader audience and, you know, people are actually recommending it to each other, then yes. But if it stops there, maybe, you know, this is not where I should be spending my energy because there are amazing authors out there. So I do value the feedback from, you know, how this book spreads out.
Well, I feel like it's unique. You know, I haven't seen another book like this. Now, I haven't gone and looked for it, but you know, I like how, I wouldn't say it's necessarily easy to read, but because there is a lot of science and math in it, but it's almost fun to read, because there's you know, you're telling a story too at the same time, and I think that's a rare, kind of a rare thing.
That was the idea, Monica. Yeah, and yes, and I kept away from tables, graphs, equations, right? There's none of that in the book on purpose, so that it's not A, intimidating, but B, it's as relatable as possible.
Right, right. Okay, so we are almost out of time. Do you have any final thoughts? Any, you know, like what's anything you want to tell our listeners to take away from this?
I hope this conversation was helpful already. I created a very short 2-page scorecard that is meant to, like, you know, remove this guilt from you if you have this guilt, which is exactly what we've talked about here today, that I'll be happy to gift you with any of your listeners, Monica. I'll send it to you and you can share, or we can put a page for your listeners. But if you want to, you know, deep dive, obviously the book is out there and available, and I'd love to hear your comments if you have the chance to read it.
Well, we'll put that link on the post of this interview on writersvoices.com so that anybody can access it that way. And thank you so much for being with us today. We always close with a quote, and I picked one from former U.S. President Barack Obama. We are the first generation to feel the effect of climate change and the last generation who can do something about it. And thank you, Pablo, for helping us understand what we need to do.
Thanks for having me, Monica, and giving me the space to amplify this voice.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.